Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're welcoming this morning students from Lincoln High School. We had some of your cohorts here earlier. Would they please stand? Thank you and welcome. You may be seated. We have students from Richland Center High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you, and you may be seated. The students are here with us on a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from all around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students are sent the briefs of the case that they will hear, and they may engage in activities that involve that case in school. In addition to that, they attend an oral argument, and after the oral argument, second argument of the day, they meet with a justice of this court. And the discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of this case. Everyone in the court is welcome to join that discussion. It's not limited to the high school students. So let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. He is the justice with whom you're going to meet today. Right after this case. Next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, a graduate of Richland Center High School, an illustrious
recent graduate. I don't know why that was so funny.
I think I'm pushing that.
A recent illustrious graduate of Richland Center High School.
Right.
I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Chief Justice. In the vacant seat next to me generally sits Justice John Wilcox, but he will not be participating in this case today. To the right of that seat is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to the at the far right is Justice Patience Rokensack. With those introductions made, I'll turn to the case we're about to hear, 04AP2232, Village of Cross Plains versus Kristen Hanstead. Representing Ms. Hanstead is John Gerlich. You may proceed, Mr. Gerlich.
My name is John Gerlach. I work for the law firm of LaRoe, Gerlach & Roy. I practice out of our Madison office. I represent Kristen Hanstead in this matter. The facts of this case are very, in my opinion, very simple, and throughout the proceedings have not been in dispute. Essentially what happened on the evening of May 25th of 2003, my client met her boyfriend at a bar in the Village of Cross Plains. She drove to the bar. Her boyfriend was already there at the bar. He had previously played in a hardball game in the Village of Cross Plains earlier that day. He received a ride to the bar from other friends, and he had left his vehicle at the baseball diamond. My client drank alcoholic beverages at the bar. She became drunk. There is no issue on that. We stipulated to that throughout these proceedings. At about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, she left the bar with her boyfriend. She gave her keys to her boyfriend. From that location, they drove back to the baseball diamond, where They also had another passenger who sat in the back seat. Basically, my client sat in the passenger seat. Her boyfriend, Mr. Sasswaite, drove the vehicle, and another individual sat in the back seat. When they arrived back to the baseball diamond parking lot, her vehicle was parked by Mr. Sasswaite next to his vehicle on the left side or on the driver's side. Mr. Sasswaite left the vehicle running, opened the door, and allowed the passenger, Mr. Cushman, to get out of the vehicle so he could get into Mr. Sasswaite's vehicle. While that was occurring, my client slid over into the driver's seat while the vehicle was on and the lights were on, and that allowed Mr. Sasswaite to get in back into the vehicle on the driver's side, and that allowed those to discuss their issue that night. And their issue was basically that my client wanted to go home with her boyfriend, but this third party was making that difficult. They were sitting there talking in that position for approximately 10 minutes when a police officer arrived, and that led to an OWI arrest. The issue, in my opinion, before the court today is the application of the statute of operate. The statute 346-63-3B defines operate as physical manipulation or activation of any of the controls necessary to put it in motion. The uncontroverted testimony throughout these proceedings, the finding by the trial court, the finding by the Court of Appeals, is that no time did my client in any way drive the motor vehicle or in any way manipulate any of the controls of the motor vehicle or in any way activate the motor vehicle. All she did was sit facing her boyfriend, who is now in the passenger seat, and talk to her boyfriend. The case law that has been cited most in the briefs that the court is obviously looking at will be the Predator case and the Supreme Court Burr case. And I would submit to the court that the Predator case is very much distinguished from the facts of this case, both on its facts and both on the issue. The Predator case involved a situation where a person started a motor vehicle, drove the motor vehicle, and then eventually pulled off the side of the road and left the vehicle on. When the officer came and made contact with that individual, he was intoxicated at that time, and the issue became not whether he had operated the motor vehicle or not whether he had drove the motor vehicle, but the issue became at that time whether he was still operating or driving the motor vehicle. So I think that's distinguished, that is clearly distinguished from our case, where Ms. Hanstead had never driven the motor vehicle, had never operated the motor vehicle, and basically it's distinguished because, in addition to those facts, the court was looking at a different issue, and there was whether it was a continuing operation. The court dealt with basically the same issue in the Byrd decision, and the issue, again, was timing. There wasn't any issue in this court's Byrd decision whether the snowmobile driver had driven the vehicle, had started the vehicle, driven it, parked it, so on and so forth. The issue became more of whether or not the vehicle at the time of the accident, whether it was still being operated. So I think basically the thrust of our case is the requirement that under the operation statute, there is a requirement that you physically manipulate and physically activate a control necessary to set in motion. And clearly, throughout these proceedings, that never happened. The issue in Predator and Byrd were totally distinguished. There was a different issue whether that person was continuing to operate a motor vehicle, and that is not the facts of this case. I really have no more to say in that. The issues are fairly simple. I don't think Predator applies, because I think Predator was dealing with a different issue and a different set of facts.
I have a question.
Yes.
I haven't. We just received some supplementary authority from your opposing counsel,
And I read some, but not all of the cases cited, certainly not all the ones from other jurisdictions cited. Is there any case that you've come across cited in either your or opposing counsel's brief or supplement that has either one of, that does not have either one or the other of these following, either direct evidence of driving or circumstantial evidence of driving? In the Flegger case, there was direct testimony. He said that he had driven there. And in other cases, there's circumstantial evidence. You know, how could that vehicle be there in the middle of the night with one person in it and car running if that person in the car didn't? Is there any case that doesn't have some circumstantial direct evidence of prior
driving? I could find no case like that.
Well, there was evidence the snowmobile had been driven by him 5 minutes before, wasn't there?
That does not have that, I asked, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gerlach, it's a matter of policy. The defendant was sitting, here's the steering wheel, here's the accelerator right below here. She's drunk. Why, as a matter of policy, shouldn't we say that, that poses such a danger that the person is going to make a mistake or actually start driving, that we should find that that's operating the vehicle?
First of all, the statute doesn't say that's operating a motor vehicle, Your Honor. The statute does not say being in that position is operating a motor vehicle. The statute clearly says that you either have to physically manipulate or activate a control. She is sitting there in a motor vehicle that's running, and I admit that. But as a matter of policy, we could say that a person in the passenger seat is as much of a risk in the vehicle, too. A person in the passenger seat, when somebody else is driving, could grab that person, could knock that person, could do something stupid. The legislature has made it very clear that the purpose prohibiting is either, number one, driving or operating. And operating really is an attempt to drive. As I read that statute, it's really just an attempt to make some effort to drive. The statute doesn't talk about whether you're in a position to do it or whether you could do it or whether it could happen. The statute is very clear that you either drove or you made some attempt to drive. And that's either putting the key in the ignition, maybe not turning it on, putting the key in the ignition and turning it on. I think the statute's very clear. That's where the court drew the line, or the legislature drew the line. So as a matter of policy, I think this is innocent behavior. I think this is something, if you ask somebody, a layperson, when would they be guilty of driving under the influence? Well, number one, you have driving. We all understand that. But number two, if you make any attempt to drive, if you make any attempt to set that car in motion, whether it can be put in motion or whether it can't be put in motion, you have violated the law. And I think people understand that. But beyond that, I don't think people understand that. Ms. Hostad that night gave her keys to her boyfriend. She knew she couldn't operate or drive that motor vehicle. She knew enough to do that.
Also, why not just concede that the policy's a good one, take it to the legislature?
I'm sorry?
Why not just concede in response to Justice Prosser's question that, yeah, that's a good policy, but that's a legislative decision. Take it to the legislature.
I agree with that.
Mr. Gerlach, let me ask you about the Pregler case, which you mentioned earlier. I'm looking at page 626 of that decision, and this is language that your opposing counsel emphasized in his brief. And it talks about the prohibition against the activation of any of the controls of a motor vehicle necessary to put it in motion applies either to turning on the ignition or leaving the motor running while the vehicle is in park. Well, isn't that exactly what we have here? Your client's sitting in the driver's seat. The motor is running. I assume the vehicle is either in neutral or in park. Doesn't Pregler apply?
No.
Why not?
Because, again, I think Pregler was limited to the issue and the facts of that case. The issue in that case, first of all, in that case, they found that this individual did operate. They found that this person drove, they started the car, drove their car there. There was no question about that, that that person did that. So they found this person under the statute that they had made that initial requirement. Then the only issue after that is whether or not, when that terminated. Did it terminate when the person got off the road? Did it terminate, according to the Pregler decision, when he decided he wasn't going to put the car in motion anymore? Did it terminate because he had the brains to get off the road? No, that applies to strictly those facts. My client did not leave the car running. My client never started the car. My client did not park the car. My client is not the one who left that car running. And, in fact, what they have proposed or what they appear to have proposed in their brief is that she should have turned the car off. And I think that is exactly the type of conduct that we don't want her to do. We don't want her to potentially put the foot on the brake where she might put her foot on the gas. We don't want her to manipulate the ignition where she might do something. We don't want her to do any of that. She did not leave that car running. She did not start that car, and she did not leave it running.
Well, who left it running?
Her boyfriend was there the whole time. Mr. Sathwaite drove the car, parked the car, left the car running, got out of the car, got back into the car. He left the car running. And pursuant to their agreement, that night, Ms. Honstad relinquished control of that motor vehicle to her boyfriend. She did exactly what we want people to do, and that's give her keys to a sober driver.
Don't you think it's significant that she's sitting in the driver's seat and you've got a car running? You know, we take the position that anything we say in our opinions is not dicta. Now, what I was listening for was you didn't say, well, this is dicta, what I just read to you. But that's the implication of what you were saying, is that that was dicta. If we follow our normal approach on things, this is not dicta. And this is the rule of law that should be applied here.
I'm not saying that is dicta. I'm saying that's held to the facts of this case. When you prosecute a drunk driving case, timing is everything. The statute requires that you cannot drive or operate a motor vehicle while intoxicated. So determining the point in which a person is operating or driving is critical. And it's a timing issue that this court, and I agree with the policy of Pregler, that the appeals court said, and it talks about activation, that you have activated it, and that activation continues as long as you're still in that car and you're under physical control. And I agree with that, because if that wasn't the law, you could have situations where a person does drive, exactly as Pregler discussed, a person does drive, and they have the brains to get off the road. Well, if we don't have the law that you're still operating at that point, as long as you have the vehicle on, people are going to do that all the time. And the case was very clear that we're trying, we don't want to encourage people to get in behind the wheel. We don't want that. I think Pregler is good law. I'm not saying it's not good law. I'm just saying it doesn't apply because it was a different issue, different facts, and they determined in Pregler that the person did operate. The person did drive. That has never happened in this case. Also,
suppose Kristen had turned off the ignition. Would she have been operating under the literal meaning of the statute?
In my opinion, yes.
Does that make sense?
In my opinion, yes. We don't want her operating the vehicle. We don't want her touching the controls. We don't want to give her the authority to put her foot on the brake where she might put her foot on the gas. We don't want her touching anything. Now, there might be some exceptions to that, an emergency or something like that. But for the most part, no. And she did not do it.
You want us to take a very literal interpretation of the statute. If we were to do that, what would be the effect on drunk driving enforcement in Wisconsin?
I just want you to say this is what the statute says and find that she did not violate the statute. From reading the briefs in this case, there's almost an implication if we do not find Ms. Hanstead guilty that everybody's being soft on drunk driving, that we're opening a floodgate here. This is a one-in-a-million fact situation. And I submit if the facts have come up before, the case was probably settled. Drunk driving law is a tough law. I prosecute, I defend these cases. It's a tough law. There's a million of checks and balances within the law. You have the implied consent law. It's not a drunk driving law. And I think that's also a misconception. It's a driving under the influence law. We have the intoxicator. We have legal limits there. We have checks and balances where you cannot get an amendment of a drunk driving unless you get court approval. It is a tough law, and it's tough enough. You're not in any way backing off on the significance of this law by finding my client innocent. The fact of the matter is she did not violate the law. I'm simply asking you to follow the law.
Mr. Gaelic, if I could follow up on Justice Prosser's question, has it been your experience? I'm assuming you handle these cases regularly. If I'm not, then please advise me. But has it been your experience that in cases like this, the judge makes decision at the trial court level is consistent with what other trial court judges are doing or inconsistent with what other trial court judges are doing?
I cannot state that any other trial court has had my facts. I can state that when you have unique facts, it is very common for the trial courts to agree and to reduce a drunk driving ticket. And usually what happens is reduced to a reckless driving or driving unreasonable and prudent driving. Requirements required that they get an assessment to make sure that there's not an alcohol issue and it's treated. But you asked me my experience as a prosecutor. I represent three municipalities. I have amended and I have asked courts to amend drunk driving tickets often.
What about the Byrd case? In that case, he had a snowmobile. It was not drunk driving. It was a snowmobile statute of operating without lights. No question that the guy operated the snowmobile. He's conceded, right? He turns off the motor. The lights go off, and he's parked there. An accident happens, and the question is, did he violate the statute about operating without lights? And therefore is negligence per se, right? Roughly. If it had been a drunk driving case and he's parked by the side of the road with the keys off, the ignition off, he would have been operating. Is that right?
No.
Why not?
As I read the Pregler case,
the engine was still running.
So I think you have the same issue that you had in the snowmobile case. You have to determine at what point did the operation cease.
Okay, but if you say the operation ceased for a drunk driving case 5 minutes ago, that guy got there by driving. You don't have to catch him in the act of driving.
No, and again,
he concedes he drove. Now the issue is whether he was drunk. And in this case, we agree he's drunk.
Right. I'm not sure if I understand the question, but...
No, my question is, if you put Byrd, it's not the same statute. Okay. So you had a 4-3 split of the court, or 4-2, whatever it was.
4-3.
4-3 split of the court. Four people said he is not operating because the motor is off, and under that statute, you have to have illumination when you're operating. He isn't operating, therefore he didn't need illumination. He was parked. Okay. If it had been a drunk driving case, he is now parked with the motor off, but there is no question that he drove to that spot 5 minutes ago. And he's as drunk now as he was 5 minutes ago. So there's circumstantial evidence that he did operate the car or snowmobile while drunk, okay, while under the influence of intoxicants. So the motor was off. Under, how would you rule on that case? How would you have the court?
Well, I'm not sure. First of all, I'm assuming, you know, to take the facts a little further, a police officer comes and he is off, and now maybe there was discussion, I drove here and I've been here for 5 minutes, I really don't know. But the facts of the matter are, then I think that's close enough in time that you can do field sobriety tests. I mean, unless there's evidence that he's drinking in the car before the police officer got there, then he's going to go through the normal field sobriety test and he's going to determine that he's impaired. Also, that you have the right to give the intoximeter test, and then
we agree he's impaired. I want to know whether or not he's going to be convicted.
He's going to be convicted because I'm assuming he's going to go in and take a breath test.
He's going to be convicted because you assume he's operating even though the car is silent when the police officer makes the arrest.
Well,
that's my point.
There would have to be some determination of when that vehicle was turned off and when he got done driving.
5 minutes ago.
And if that was the evidence that came in, he would be convicted.
Okay. That's all I'm trying to know. And the difference here is that you got a different statute in Berg.
Well, it's a different statute, but it reads the same.
But the court held he wasn't operating.
Correct.
But he
wasn't operating at that. You weren't looking back and saying whether he was operating 5 minutes before he parked there.
Because he may have had the lights on 5 minutes ago.
Because he may have been driving 5 minutes ago. And what was critical in the Berg decision is timing. And again, timing was, what was he doing at the time of that accident? And if that would have been a drunk snowmobile case, which I don't know exactly what the law is, I'm assuming that he would have been found of driving while a snowmobile while impaired.
I'm dying to know what was going to happen to Kristen's car that night if things had played out as they expected.
It's been a while since I've talked to my client. There's a brief explanation of that in the transcript. The explanation is that her car was going to be left there, and Mr. Statuswaith was going to take her home and then take home Mr. Cushman, and because both Mr. Cushman, the passenger, and Mr. Statuswaith lived in Middleton. So the plan was that he was going to take her home. He knew I didn't want to spend the night with her. It was clear. She was too drunk. I mean, I think that's a given. And that he was going to drop her off, and then he was going to go home. He was going to drop Mr. Cushman off and go home. They both lived in Middleton. They both had a baseball game the next morning. I cannot answer why Mr. Sandthwaite let that motor vehicle running. I just cannot answer that. I never have talked to him, and I can't represent that fact. But why Ms. Hassett was upset that night is because instead of going home with him, he was going to take her home and then take home Mr. Cushman. And that's the best explanation I can give you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Gerlach. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Kenneth Biax, representing the Village of Cross Plains.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kenneth Axe. As you heard, I'm from the law firm of Lathrop & Clark in Madison. I'm representing the Village of Cross Plains. That is a small municipality located in Dane County, approximately 3,000 persons. The Village brought this case, appealed to the Court of Appeals, and has continued because of what it perceives to be the significance and the importance to the safety of the Village residents as well as the citizens of this state. The statute in question, Section 346.63, the state's drunk driving law, was considered by the Court of Appeals in Pregler in 1980, where the Court of Appeals found that the statute was clear, in its words, and that restraining the movement of a parked running vehicle or leaving the engine running while the vehicle is in park is operating under the statute. It did not discuss shifting into park, proving that one had driven to the location at which time the person in the vehicle was found in order to find a violation of the statute.
Well, Mr. Axe, if I can ask you.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm looking at Judge Higginbotham's decision on page 6, your appendix page 22. And in paragraph 17, the judge indicated that Hanstad testified that while sitting in the driver's seat of the Cavalier, she never touched or manipulated the gas pedal, steering wheel, or the ignition, or any of the controls of the car. She testified she did nothing more than sit in the driver's seat with her feet and body facing the passenger seat. And the village presented no testimony to the contrary. I look at the statute, section 346.63(3)(b), as well as the jury instruction in this case, that defines the term operate. Operate means the physical manipulation or activation of any of the controls of a motor vehicle necessary to put it in motion. Now, unless the court is about the business of rewriting that statute, why isn't that the end of the case?
Your Honor, I think there's two answers to that. First, while the Pregler court stated that the statute was clear, we now have two courts in this case, the trial court and the court of appeals, which have found different interpretations or constructions of the statute. As Justice Abramson wrote, in Lincoln Savings Bank versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue and in her concurrence, when courts or judges disagree about the meaning of a statute or interpretation of the law is by definition capable of being understood by reasonably well-informed persons.
I think if it's a reasonable disagreement, but go ahead.
Judges. I think that's the way she wrote it. Even though one interpretation might on careful analysis be seen more suitable to the Supreme Court. And so under that analysis, which I think the Court of Appeals has also used in a case, this statute would be considered ambiguous, and therefore the rules of construction could come into play, such as legislative intent. And although the Court speaks in the tenets of construction about looking at the meaning of the words, it also talks about the primary aim is to discern the intent of the legislature and carry that out, which we think supports the construction found by the Court of Appeals in this case. But also, if one does look at those words, neither of the parties cited any dictionary definitions, nor did the Court of Appeals, nor did Judge Nix. When you look at the meanings, and that's why yesterday we supplemented with some synonyms and some dictionaries, activate means to make active, and active means acting, functioning, working, capable of functioning, in operation or effect. Our position with respect to that term would be that one gets behind the wheel of a running motor vehicle. They are taking advantage of or permitting the controls of that vehicle, such as the transmission, the parking brake, the engine, to be operating and to be in effect, to be active.
Leading off one of the adjectives that go along with activation, it's physical manipulation or activation. So where is the physical manipulation or physical activation here? Maybe I'm missing something. Unless there's some touching of something, and your opposing counsel has conceded that had she turned it off, she'd be manipulating. In the absence of manipulation, and in the absence of this court rewriting this statute, I mean, you make a good public policy argument, but should you be making it here or should you be making it to the legislature?
I think the reference to physical means that the control has to be in effect, in operation, not controlling in the sense of go drive that vehicle over there or suggesting somebody do something, but actually having a physical operation. And that's where the engine running, which makes this vehicle a dangerous instrumentality, which makes it something which could injure somebody, which makes it something if an intoxicated person is behind the wheel, it's posing a risk or danger.
Well, suppose I was my 14-year-old child, no license. I leave the car, I leave it running, I'm just running into the cleaners to pick up something, and he slides from the passenger seat to the driver's seat, touches nothing, but feels really big and important being behind the wheel. And if there was a statute saying the same thing about a minor, as we say about somebody under the influence, would you say that he could be clipped under that statute?
Yes, Your Honor, because he's taken the action of getting behind that wheel, which poses the risk, the danger, that the legislature was seeking to avoid. by being in that position, he could decide he's going to feel even bigger and hit the control. He could lean over and accidentally touch it. He's in creating much more of a risk than if he's sitting in the passenger side or in the back. And it's that kind of behavior that the legislature is seeking to avoid.
In many cases, a passenger could move the car to operate that car without moving into the driver's seat.
I think that's probably true, but that is not this case. And I believe, I would submit, that the legislature has not gone that far. And in any event, we don't have a case like Kregler, which would suggest that the passenger, at least not in this jurisdiction. I believe there have been cases in other jurisdictions suggesting that a passenger in that situation with a running vehicle could still be in control and operating the vehicle. I don't think we have that here today, and I don't think the court has to reach that. We're suggesting that the most immediate danger is when the intoxicated person is behind the wheel.
So you're relying on Kregler, paragraph 11 of it, page 629, that says operation occurs either when you start the motor or leave it running. And here, her failure to turn it off meant, you're saying, inaction of failure to turn it off equals action of leaving it running.
Yes, there's a decision made to get into the position, not just failure to turn off, but to get behind the wheel. She could certainly have had her boyfriend continue behind the driver's wheel. She could have had him turn it off. She did not do so. And by putting herself behind the wheel, she then was in control of that motor vehicle and at any time could have activated, whether intentional or unintentional, as the Court of Appeals noted in Kregler.
Suppose that the boyfriend had turned it off. She's now in the passenger seat. Is that enough?
I think that if the boyfriend had turned it off and she was sitting in the passenger seat, we probably would not be here today.
You wouldn't be here. But on the other hand, the public policy issue of somebody who has control, keys are there, she knows how to drive, she's in the driver's seat, within seconds she can be starting it and moving it, right? So if the public policy is to penalize somebody who is under the influence of intoxicants, who has the power or has control, so that you don't let them have that, be in that position, that's for public safety, would cover her.
I think the statute would not likely cover her because the risk is less. There always have to be lines drawn. Certainly, you could suggest that being outside the car with the keys in her pocket, she could open the door, get in, turn on the ignition, and drive away. That is not the same as sitting behind the wheel of a running motor vehicle. Just as, although it's a different statute, safety statute and so forth, the fact that the engine was not running in Berg was relied upon by this court to make a great distinction and to find that there was no control at that time. In fact, when I read through it, I counted 7 different times the court noted that the engine was not running, and Justice Crooks in his dissent noted that the majority seemed to focus on that to distinguish the case from Kregler and to find no violation. Here the engine is running and the person is behind the wheel. And in many of the cases we cited, which admittedly do not have statutes which read identical to Wisconsin, still the courts are noting that the legislative intent is prophylactic. It's to deter drunk drivers from getting behind the wheel where they might take action.
Counselor, I want to change a couple of facts for you. The parties are as they were. They drive to the parking lot. Mr. Satterwhite parks the car. His friend gets out of the back seat, and he goes to let him in. Satterwhite goes to let him in his SUV. Car is still running. Instead of getting into the passenger side of the car, he gets into the back seat of her car, and she scoots over into the middle of the front seat and then turns around to talk to him. So her fanny is sitting in the middle of the front seat, but now he is sitting behind the driver's seat, so her feet are really in the compartment that a driver would operate. Is she violating the statute?
I think that if she, at that point, as you describe it, is in a position where she can control that vehicle and can drive off, she turns around to talk to him and hits the transmission, She is in an argument with him at that point, and apparently the facts are such that the officer was concerned there was some sort of domestic disturbance going on. She changes her mind because she's upset, and now she starts moving the vehicle or hits the gas pedal. I think that the danger is there, and I think that she could well be found to be operating. I think that that would be a very unusual set of circumstances.
But, Counselor,
most cars don't seem to have a middle seat to me, but...
Oh, well, yeah, if they have bucket seats, they don't. You're absolutely right. My husband drives a Buick, however, a Buick's. I have a middle seat in the front.
Okay.
That I can...
Got me there.
Yeah. So then you're really looking at the opportunity to drive the car as an element of violating it, but aren't there many opportunities for all of us to break the law and we don't take them up on it and we don't get charged with violating the law?
Certainly, Your Honor, but I think the legislature has indicated here, as in some other cases, that there's a difference, that there's a risk involved where a line is being drawn. Courts have said that motor vehicles are dangerous instrumentalities. The Illinois court said, for example, particularly when an intoxicated driver gets behind the wheel. And so the idea is to deter somebody who is intoxicated from ever being in that position where they may not make rational decisions, where they do not have the same hand-eye coordination. They may accidentally knock the controls, as the Pregler court indicated. By analogy to firearms, the legislature has decided that convicted felons, I believe, are not entitled to possess firearms. All the time, other people are allowed to have firearms. Maybe a felon would never use it, but there's been a decision here, there's a risk.
If a convicted felon is in a restaurant and someone that has the right to carry a gun brings it out of their pocket and sits it on the table, he doesn't get charged with carrying or being in possession of because it was sitting on the table and he could have grabbed it and then been in possession, right?
No, I guess the point I'm trying to make is simply that the legislature has decided that the risk of use of that firearm is too great to permit the felon to have it in their possession. Similarly, the risk of driving off of this vehicle, being in motion and hurting somebody, is too great. And that's why the statute was amended in 1977, although we could not find something in the drafting file, but that's why it went from being operated or drive, meaning the same thing, where it had to be in motion, to violations under operate, where the vehicle does not have to be in motion, because there is the risk there that it could be put into motion. If all that mattered was that the vehicle was moving, then the old definition would have applied.
Yeah. So I haven't looked at the legislative history at all, but it seems to me that perhaps the reason to change to this activation is the kind of cases, and I was a city prosecutor for 3 years and prosecuted a lot of these, just as you folks have, many more than I am sure. But, you know, inevitably you get these cases where they're parked in the middle of nowhere and they've been drinking, you know, but now the car's not in motion. And that change in legislative history would take that, the change in the legislative enactment would take that kind of fact situation into consideration, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, looking at Pregler, for example, the Court of Appeals went through a lengthy analysis of the statute, legislative intent, the legislative history that I'm talking about, and it was only at the very end, almost as an afterthought, that the Court said, and what's more, there's circumstantial evidence that this person must have driven the vehicle here because how did it get there?
I thought in Pregler he testified that he... I don't think that – I didn't know it was a circumstantial case. He testified that he drove in Pregler, I thought.
Well, he did, Your Honor, but they say we agree with the trial court's finding that the circumstantial evidence in this case was sufficient to substantiate the fact that the defendant had operated the vehicle. The point I was trying to make was that he testified he had parked the vehicle at 1:15 to 1:30. The police found him around 3:30 with the vehicle running. There's no evidence suggested about hands-on controls, anything like that. I think he wasn't tested until 4:30 or about 3 hours after he had parked the vehicle. And so in the briefs, when you go back, there's a suggestion from the defense that there was not evidence to suggest that he was intoxicated at the time the vehicle had been parked at 1:15 or 1:30. He had stipulated when they tested him, but there's none of the scientific evidence that says 3 hours ago he would have been 0.8 or 0.1 if that was the standard at the time. So the court was really looking at that point, not at just finding somebody who had driven with the hand on the control in drive and going over the curb, the court was looking at whether being in a rental vehicle at that time an intoxicated was operating.
But counsel, if I could follow up Justice Bradley's question, there's no need to talk about circumstantial evidence of operation if the Court of Appeals had bought into your definition of operation. You'd have actual direct evidence of operation if the court felt it necessary to refer to circumstantial evidence.
I would agree, and I'm not sure why the court was mentioning circumstantial when it talked about having driven as opposed to when he was found, which was what the rest of the opinion discusses and seems to say there's no issue about his state at the time he was found or the condition of the vehicle. And they're certainly not saying that when he was found his hands were on the controls or anything like that. When I look at Pregler, I also look even at the statement of this court, and I think it's Elkhart Lake, where the court simply says, found a vehicle engine running in a parking lot under Pregler he was operating. No discussion of whether hands were in controls, no discussion of when he had driven there, how long ago, had somebody else driven to the parking lot or started the vehicle. This court was reading Pregler, as I see it, in that short statement in Elkhart, as that he was operating because the vehicle was running and he was behind the wheel in the position to control it.
And he was the only one around.
Yes. That is true. He was the only one around.
I want to, in response to one of Justice Rogensack's questions, you said, well, you got to draw the line, the question of the person being in the middle of the front bench seat. And it seems to me then you're drawing the line there, that if a person is in the middle, they can be charged with OWI?
As I understood her factual situation, I thought she was saying that the person's feet were right at the pedals. Even though they're at the middle, they were at the pedals, not next to the driver's seat and next to the controls.
I didn't understand, so let me just put my own then. If a person, take Justice Rogensack's hypothetical, the person is in the middle of the front bench. The person is turned around, and turning around would have, you know, the right foot in the driver's well, if you will. You know, not up on the brakes or the butt, but you're turning around, and you, oftentimes there's a, a little hump in the middle of the bench if it's a stick. And a lot of the trucks these days just have benches in the front seat. So you're turning around and you're talking. Is that person, and the person's drunk, although has never driven the auto, is that person then subject to being found guilty of drunk driving?
So they're sitting in the middle seat, their foot is next to the gas pedal or brake?
No. Foot is, next to is relative. Right. And they're turning around, and so it's in the well, but it's not on the brake or there. It's just right next to it, with no immediate contact, has that, to either the brake or pedal.
I don't think that person would be operating, but I would say it's an unusual factual situation. You asked during the prior argument whether we could find cases that were on all fours, basically. Mm-hmm. And the answer was not published decisions. Most of these in Wisconsin appear to be one-judge appeals, as in this case, which are not published. And you haven't asked whether there were any found and unpublished, and I guess I can't speak to that. But
how about in other jurisdictions? Because you cited some other jurisdictions.
Yes, I did not come across a case like that. I did come across a case, I suppose, where somebody was in the passenger compartment, and I can't tell you which case sitting here right now, but where somebody was in the passenger compartment, and that court still found that they were controlling the vehicle, that they were still in a position to cause harm, and still found them guilty.
What case is that?
I could tell you later, I can't tell you from
If I were on the back of a motorcycle, and God forbid, drunk, and the driver left the cycle running and went and bought some cigarettes. I'm really wild.
This is getting good. It's that Mitchell said our high school thing.
That wasn't funny.
There you go.
you should know, if I recall, you have a relative from Richland Center. Is that person subject to being found guilty of operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated?
I do not believe so. I don't think that person is in the position to have the control and to create the kind of risk that there would be if that person scooted down and was now in the driver's seat.
And Counselor, I'm sorry. I want to give you another hypothetical. Let's say he gets out of the car. She's still in the passenger seat. Car's running. And he's in the car talking to his buddy, trying to get his buddy to take his car home so they can get together. Officer comes over. She's the only one in the car. Car's running. Has she violated the statute?
No. I don't believe that she...
She's still in a position operating it. Nobody else is there. If she wanted to leave, she certainly could.
But she's in the passenger seat. And the distinction that I'm drawing and that I think other courts have drawn is there's a much greater danger of activating, of knocking a control or deciding to drive off when somebody is in the driver's seat than when they're elsewhere in the car.
So it's the driver's seat that you think is a dispositive fact in this case.
And the fact that the vehicle is running. Okay. I think there would be a different situation if the vehicle was not running. There would not be the same kind of risk of harm.
Mr. Axe, other courts, of course, are interpreting other statutes based upon their jurisdictions. I want to go back to our statute, and I'd like you to direct me to exactly what control necessary to put the vehicle in motion was activated, since you don't contest physical manipulation, was activated by this defendant in this case. What control necessary to put the vehicle in motion was activated?
Well, let me just add one thing. You said, with respect to manipulation, there are definitions of manipulate.
This physical manipulation is the first. So giving you the benefit of the doubt, which I'm not necessarily in agreement with, the physical doesn't attach to activation. I'm trying to make it easy for you. We'll do the activation side. Because I don't think there's any evidence in this record that she physically manipulated anything. So what control did she activate to put the vehicle in motion?
The restraint of the vehicle, as the court noted in Pregler, was the transmission, which was in park, as here, and permitting the engine to continue to run. That decision, getting in the position and permitting the engine to run, was the control that the court was finding was necessary under the definitions of activate and manipulate.
With all due respect, Mr. Axe, I don't think you've answered my question. My question goes directly to the statute. What control of the motor vehicle, what was her control, what control of the motor vehicle did she activate necessary to put the vehicle in motion?
And my answer is still, as in Brevard, that the activation or manipulation was of those controls which were permitted to continue to engage the vehicle and keep it from moving at that point, the decision that it would move. And in Brevard, the question was not when the vehicle was parked 2 or 3 hours before. The question was at the time, as counsel indicated, at the time that the defendant was arrested, the time he was found by the police officers. And I'm suggesting that this should be construed in light of legislative intent to have the broadest reach to protect the citizens of this state. This is unusual, where the legislature has actually put into the statute, as well as the session laws, findings as to its intent that this statute be vigorously enforced. It's even taken away some discretion from prosecutors and courts. That's
what I'm going to ask another question, Mr. Axe, but now I have to. Admittedly, there is some disagreement on this court about when you get to issues of legislative intent. But for those of us who take the plain meaning approach, how do you get to legislative intent given the language of the statute?
And as I indicated before, Your Honor, since the statute has been construed in different ways by different judges, different courts, it is ambiguous. And therefore, I believe that one can look not only at the words of the statute, but also the legislative intent, the evil that sought to be remedied, the public policy, as was asked about before, the questions of enforcement, and the suggestions that there would be questions of when somebody had been driving, when they had first been drinking, how long ago they parked. If two people are in the vehicle, each one says the other had driven the vehicle and parked it. There's a bright line rule that's being articulated here that says you don't get behind the wheel if you're intoxicated. It's fine to get a designated driver. Keep the designated driver. And Pregler has been out there for 25 years without the legislature taking any action to suggest that there was a problem with it or that there were any ambiguities arising or that it was being misapplied in cases that were out there. That suggests that the legislature at least has found Pregler, depending upon how it reads it, as being consistent with its intent, or it would have changed the law in some fashion.
With all due respect, Mr. Axe, having sat on a municipal court for 10 years and in a circuit court for 2 years and hearing a number of OWI cases, my suspicion is that a number of the trial courts are interpreting Pregler a little bit differently than you are.
Well, Your Honor, since I can't cite unpublished decisions, I don't know that I can disagree with that, but I'd certainly direct the court to look at how trial courts appear to be interpreting Pregler in different situations in this state, but I would respectfully disagree.
Mr. Axe, do you think that if we were to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals here, that we would have to overrule not only Pregler, but Elkhart Lake and Motory as well?
I think that you would have to overrule Pregler or find some way of distinguishing it, which I'm not sure would be consistent with the facts and the evidence that were in that case, as I discussed with respect to when the person had admitted they were drinking, when they parked. This is not the five-minute case that was posited as a hypothetical. In Elkhart Lake, I'm not sure because the issue really involved whether the person was on a highway or a place held out to the public. So the assumption was from the very beginning that they were operating. So I don't think that would be a problem.
Elkhart Lake was the parking lot case?
Yeah, I think that was the one that was in the AMC lot. And Justice Heffernan said the person is driving, the person was operating under Pregler. Now the question is, under the statutes as amended to expand from highway, was this a place where they were not allowed to be operating at the time? In Midori, the roadway case.
Was that the roadway issue? Roadway? Never mind. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. In Midori, the issue was whether the vehicle could have been moved because it was on an embankment or a ditch, something like that.
Hung up, was it not?
Right. And I think there would be a problem with that because under the interpretation that the vehicle could not be moved, I suppose the distinction there maybe is that they were observed trying to get off the embankment, moving back and forth, trying to. There was some suggestion of motion there, even though it was stuck on the embankment. And so perhaps the line could be drawn without overruling that. I certainly think that it would be difficult with Pregler at this point in time.
Could I ask, suppose that Kristen had been revoked at the time this incident occurred, would she? Suppose Kristen's license had been revoked.
Yes, sir.
Would she also be guilty of operating after revocation?
I think that the definition under that statute is different, but I'm not positive. I did not really look at that statute. So I know that there's a definition of operator under the Motor Vehicle Code, which is different. And I don't know whether the definition 346.63 also applies for operating after revocation, so I can't really answer that question. So,
well, you can be sent, OWI can be criminal, can it not?
Yes.
So that under certain circumstances, you're saying that simply sitting in the driver's seat, not touching anything, while intoxicated, could send you to jail?
If that's the penalty, I think there would also be some prosecutorial discretion which could apply at that point and which might go to ameliorate those circumstances. But I'm reading the legislature's statements as the statute has been broadened both by the legislature and even by this court in some of the decisions. For example, not to require motion. For example, not to have to be on a highway. For example, not to require an intent to move in Pregler. And in another case of this court, not to require that the intoxication was interfering with operation or impairing. As the legislature has found that this is a greater evil, the legislature has sought to broaden the reach and even taken away some discretion, I think there would still be some discretion available in that situation. with respect to whether to prosecute and also what kind of a penalty. But the bottom line is, yes, I think that getting behind the wheel of a running motor vehicle while intoxicated is enough of a risk to harm not only the person who gets behind the wheel, but others, that the legislature intended it to be covered by this law.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
Thank you.
Mr. Gerlach.
I just have a few comments. Council has indicated that we should, the legislature has indicated the strong public policy, and we should make the broadest interpretation possible. And I think we all have to remember that we're here in a civil case. And as the court has noted, that this same definition is applied to second, third, fourth, fifth offense OWIs, and it's criminal. And when the court asked him questions about where do we draw the line, it's clear to me that the line was moving all over the board. What you have is also not only what he's arguing is not where the line is, but where the line may be about opportunity and what accidentally could happen and all those kinds of things. That isn't the line. The legislature has made it very clear what the line is. And the line is number one, drive. And we all know what drive means. Although there's some dispute on that, but I think everybody in this courtroom, in this hearing room, knows what drive means. It means getting behind the wheel and moving it and eventually stopping it, you stop driving. The legislature added back in 1975, operate. And operate is clear what that means. It's some physical manipulation or activation. It's some effort. It is some effort to put that car in motion. And that is the bright line. And that is what is... And that's still the test of time, quite frankly. I mean, he talks about it being there for 25 years. Everybody understands that. Now, all of a sudden, he's asking this court on some public policy issue to just broaden it. And that nobody can define what that is. So I also, one of the hypotheticals was very interesting. And he's also talking about if you're behind the driver's seat, you're a danger. You're the most dangerous person in the world. But yet there was a hypothetical about being a passenger drunk on a motorcycle. And I would submit that that passenger is more of a danger to the road than the hypothetical when the person goes into the store to get the cigarettes. She is more than likely going to cause an accident as a passenger doing something stupid in that position. So where are we going to draw the line? If we're going to continue to move it like this, my belief is that this law is very tough. Anybody who has prosecuted or defended these people knows that this law is tough. There's a million ways to get people on driving under the influence. The standards are there, and it's kept people off the roads. The fact of the matter is, my client did not violate the statute. She did not operate that motor vehicle at any time. She did not exert control. Her boyfriend, she gave her keys. She did exactly what we wanted her to do. She gave her keys to her boyfriend, and he maintained control of that motor vehicle throughout the night. But no more to offer, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gerlach, and thank you, Mr. Axe, for your discussion of what constitutes operating a motor vehicle under the influence. That concludes our hearing on 048P2232, Cross Plains versus Onstad. The court will be in recess for lunch. Justice Butler will be out shortly to talk to the students and whoever wishes to stay for that discussion. We're in recess until 1:30.